Hey, how are you? I was just, I was in the neighborhood, and I thought I'd stop by, see what's cooking.
That Julio?
Yeah.
What do I say?
Tell her to come down. Prove to her you're the man.
Come down. I'm the man.
Get tough. Tell her you're bad.
I'm bad.
Like you mean it.
Allison, I'm bad.
No, no, no. Jump up and down.
I am so bad.
Be angry.
I am so bad.
Who are you talking to?
Julio. And a hedge.
I'm so bad, I should be in detention.
What do you say when there are no words? Feel a song that's never been heard.
Sing.
How do you know when you hear the call?
Answer.
What do you do when you've done it all?
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Stuff We've Seen. This is Jim. And now, a man whose negotiation skills are so powerful, he got his Sea Org contract down to 995 million years, Teal. All right, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. Enjoying the summer movie season. Oh, wait, no, I'm not. I didn't go see Aladdin. The rest of my family went without me.
That movie had zero appeal to me.
Yeah.
I watched the preview and I saw, this looks like a big bag of crap and not the great animated film, so why do I need to see it?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was going to tank, so I guess I was wrong.
I guess, yes, you predicted that incorrectly. My daughter loved it. I said, what was so good about it? She said, well, first of all, it's live action, so that makes it better.
Oh, that's sad. Is this the youngest or the oldest?
The oldest.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I feel like that reaction is what my littlest, if he saw it, would have said.
Well, she's just kind of at that age where, cartoons are for kids. And she's more grown up now, so she wants live action.
I hear you. Yeah, my oldest, I mean, thankfully they're kind of out of the animated stage because Secret Life of Pets, no. Thank both of my sons are like not going to see that, but they did see the first one.
I think I'm going to see it tomorrow, actually.
Ooh, yeah, that's where I say, you know what? Is it that important to go to the movies? And I can say no, but my oldest, he has some nostalgia because he grew up when like Pixar was still in its heyday before
right.
They started to falter a bit. And I think he wants to see the new Toy Story. My littlest probably could care less.
I want to see the new Toy Story.
Yeah, but let's face it. It doesn't look that good, though, and we can admit that, right?
Well, I haven't seen any of the trailers, so.
Oh, of course not, because you don't watch those.
So I know nothing about it other than it's Toy Story 4. I saw the poster.
Yes, Toy Story 4, please no more. That'll be the tagline. So before we get into the program here, just a few things I thought that I'd throw out, maybe some quick recommendations. And then, you know, the rock and roll episodes that we did, I thought were a lot of fun. And I just can't believe that I forgot two movies. There were thousands, but I just can't believe, because we were sort of talking around genres that were very close to them. But we didn't mention Alan Parker's Fame.
Mm-hmm. Or The Commitments.
But we've talked about The Commitments before. But I thought Fame is like that movie meant something to me growing up. And then Milos Forman's Hair.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to throw out a recommendation. If you have HBO, a lot of people do and have been watching that series Chernobyl.
Yes.
I don't know if you got to see that.
Not yet. I'm a little worried about it, actually, to tell you.
Why are you worried about it?
I'm worried.
That's weird.
I'm worried that I'm not in, that I won't be in the right mental space to handle something that intense.
You know, I think it's done very well. And, you know, again, it's broken out into five parts, which seems odd because most of these limited series are like six episodes right. or eight episodes or 10. And I think a lot of times the episode number is driven by the studio or the streaming service's desire to have more episodes. Right. And rather than drag this series out to the point where it's boring or giving you details that just didn't need to be there, this series just told its story in five episodes and was the perfect length, even though one would expect the last episode to kind of just be a wrap-up, doesn't really need to do too much, and it was kind of a waste. It actually turned out to be, I thought, the most exciting and best episode.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a great story all around, very important, only in that it just shows you when a government decides that its value and perception is more important than the health and well-being of its people.
Right.
It's going to make a series of blunders and mistakes that could have catastrophic ramifications. And so this movie is pretty chilling, or this TV.
Yeah, that's why I'm worried about it.
Well, you know, I think you can handle it.
I can definitely handle it. I was just saying, you know, it's not like watching, I don't know, Secret Life of Pets 2, which I'm
okay.
Which I really
you can handle that.
Which I really actually don't want to see at all. I didn't.
Maybe you're going to need to see Chernobyl just to take the weight off.
I think that's true. After I see that, I'm going to come home and be like, man, I need to watch people get radiation poisoning.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's dystopian all the way, except for it's, you know, it's non-fictional
right.
dystopian. And what it makes pretty clear is that a couple of things and decisions that didn't get, you know, didn't happen, we might have been looking at like most of Europe contaminated right. for thousands of years. So that's a recommendation. Another recommendation I have is a series that I'd seen kicking around Amazon. You know, they're always flashing up. Hear all our original series, and you know, you just see a photo, and yeah. you have to get interested in a photo. And I ignored it for a couple of years, and then there was a new season that had just launched, and I've been hearing a lot of people talk about it. Suddenly, it went from not ever hearing a peep out of this show to everybody talking about it. So I turned it on. And I thought, oh, we'll just check it out, and in 2 minutes, I had to shut it off. And the reason I had to shut it off is because I realized very quickly that this was going to be a great show and that if I watched it without my wife, later she would kill me.
Right.
And it's a quick series, right? Two seasons, six episodes each. They're half an hour, no more, no less.
Yes.
And do you know what it is?
I know what you're talking about. I haven't seen it, but I know what you're talking about because everyone's yes. talking about it.
Fleabag.
Yes.
All right. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is the writer, creator, and star. And it's sort of a fourth wall breaking show. It's probably the best fourth wall breaking show I've ever seen.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because that usually can grow old really quick.
Yes, it
can. It's more of a stunt, but not in this case. And I just think that as a man watching this series, I really enjoyed it. And there was some stuff that I had not seen done before on a show. Mm-hmm. But from my wife's perspective, it's sort of a new female hero.
Very cool.
This is just a great show. I suggest you watch it with your wife, and you'll find pretty quickly that you'll just want to watch both seasons very fast.
Okay, yeah, and it's not a lot of time, so that can be...
No, you can get through it really quick, and I just, it's really enjoyable. And I don't want to really tell you anything about it because there's lots of things to be surprised about. So just go with it and enjoy it.
Okay.
So that's, I think, into the recommendation portion.
I have a couple of dis recommendations.
Wait, dis? You mean no, non-like warnings?
Yes, like warnings. Like you should not watch these movies.
Okay.
The first one is a Netflix movie. You know, I should know better at this point.
Now, when you say Netflix, something on Netflix or it's a Netflix original?
It's, well...
Or was it like one of these that they purchased so they have some content and it's a movie that would have been just straight to DVD?
Well, okay, it's an Australian film and it was financed by the Australian Film Commission. So it's all locally financed in Australia. Okay. So Netflix bought it. And maybe, you know,
at a festival or something.
Exactly. And it made it.
Or at a market, like a, one of those film markets.
Exactly. They bought it at one of those. And, it, you know, so it may have been theatrical in Australia or something. It's called I Am Mother. And it's a super low budget. Actually, the budget's not as low as I thought it was originally, but it's fairly low budget sci-fi movie about after the end of the world, this robot raises a human child and teaches it. And there's lots of plot twists and stuff. And I can't recommend this movie. It just is lame. Unless, and this is the reason I watched it. You know where I'm going. I'm a subgenre completionist.
You are. And, you know, you're already describing something that my wife would like to watch.
Oh, she, you know, she.
And I've seen the trailer, so, and she has too, and she's like, oh, I want to watch that.
And here's the thing. It's not terrible. It's actually watchable. It just makes some mistakes that kind of undermine it. It's like it didn't fully think through the interesting parts of its concept. And so it threw in some twists that are kind of pointless. But your wife will like this. It's a good, it's a decent low-budget sci-fi movie. But it's also a bunker movie, which is a little bit of a subgenre.
You mean like the 80s Day of the Dead, where they're all in a bunker?
Exactly. That's a bunker movie. 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Netflix is like the king of bunker films. Even the Bird Box was a bit of a bunker film.
Bird Box is a bit of a, yeah. So it's basically a film that takes place like in a, it's basically a post-apocalyptic bottle movie is what it is. So anyhow, I Am Mother. Don't check it out unless you're James's wife.
Whose wife?
Yours. Jim's wife.
Jim's wife. Yes. Right.
Don't check it out unless you're Jim's wife. And in that mm-hmm. case, I guess Jim has to check it out too, but.
All right, you said you had another one.
Yeah, and the other one I'm not going to go into any detail on, but I happen to see it, and I think other people already know not to watch this, but just as a reminder, don't watch Ant-Man and Wasp.
I think I tried to tell you.
Oh, you told me.
That's right, I went into a rant about it, that like I didn't like the how, even in Marvel terms, the crazy logic.
The crazy logic, but also I found that the production values were kind of low.
Oh, yeah. They definitely do not give the same amount of money to the Ant-Man movies that they do to the others.
Yes. It definitely did not look like they were putting the special effects budget in. So
if you look at the if you take it from beginning to end and you have to line up all of those Marvel movies, you know, from best to worst.
Yeah.
Ant-Man and the Wasp, for me, is the worst of them all. And that's putting it ahead of Thor, the first one. And it's putting it ahead of Thor, the second one. And then, of course, Ant-Man's in there, too, because that's the regular Ant-Man's pretty bad, too.
I didn't mean to derail us on Marvel movies.
Doesn't matter. This is what the show is. The show should be called Stuff We Derail, because that's what we do.
Anyhow, Ant-Man, don't watch it. I know you've seen it, but I'm just, I guess if you're a Marvel film completionist, you kind of have to see it.
Let us talk about a couple of movies that we saw that we feel are also warnings for people not to see.
Okay, I guess we have to talk about The Wandering Earth.
I bet you people out there are like, what is that?
The Wandering Earth is the most successful movie in Chinese history, right? I think.
It may be, but I do know that it made this year $690 million.
Right. Just in China, I think.
10 million of that is worldwide gross.
Right. Okay. So it's
680 of it is in China.
Chinese produced movie, and it's a massive hit in China. The premise is that the sun is going to pop or something. And so they've got to move the Earth to a different solar system. So they put giant engines on the planet and try to shoot it out to another solar system. And the entire movie is about they're supposed to slingshot around Jupiter and something goes wrong and the Earth is going to crash into Jupiter. It's kind of a big action adventure, end of the world environmental thing. And I guess it is an action adventure movie is the best way to put it. It's got to be one of the dumbest movies I've ever seen in my life.
I'm always interested in a movie that isn't from, you know, America and Hollywood, yeah, that is this huge hit, and I kind of want to know why.
Yeah, what's the appeal here?
Yeah, then I discovered good old Netflix. They bought it, And I thought, I don't know if this is going to be any good, but I got to check this out. And so I told you about it and said, we should both watch this movie. Big mistake. I'm going to keep my big mouth shut.
There were so many times at which I almost stopped watching the movie.
I finally gave up. I was there.
Wait, you didn't finish it?
No. I was physically in the living room for the entire movie. But a lot of it, I got to say, I was on my phone.
I watched this movie. I actually paid attention throughout it. I read all the subtitles. The plot just turns on a dime. It's like, we're all doing this. And then literally seconds later, the plot just shifts to something completely different. Even if you are paying attention, it's really hard to maintain the thread of the narrative because it just is frayed all over the place.
The special effects sometimes went from pretty wild, good CGI to some really awful CGI. Yes. I've never seen a movie that had so many cuts. This thing, every 2 seconds, it edited to something. It was insane.
Yes, and it felt like that from scene to scene, too. It was like I was saying, the story just flips on a dime over and over again. It's really kind of hard to follow at times. And, okay, here's another issue. And I think maybe this is something that got lost in translation for me. If you're doing a movie like this that has this kind of a big, completely ridiculous, scientifically unsound concept, you got to have some fun with it.
It didn't feel like much fun.
Yeah, so there's, so I'm thinking about the Meg.
It's a megalodon.
He's kidding, right?
Right. Why was that a Doritos movie for me and something like this isn't? Because people were having fun. It was like, exactly. There was a vibe to it.
They knew that the movie was ridiculous and they were having some fun with that. And it was a little bit tongue in cheek and they embraced the silliness of the concept. In The Wandering Earth, they do not embrace the silliness. So there's a couple different directions you can go. You can either go to the silliness and embrace that, or you can go to the metaphorical and embrace that. And that's what Snowpiercer does.
Kind of wish that at one point they looked out their window because there's like, and that they saw the Snowpiercer train go by. It would have been pretty funny.
But the thing is, Snowpiercer has a completely ridiculous concept of this train that goes around the planet in perpetuity. It's just a ridiculous concept, but they, instead of trying to treat it realistically, they treat it all as metaphor.
Yeah, but yet within its own rules, it works though. Like, I mean, it sets up like this is how it all happened and this is why and all blah, 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 blah. And then there's a bigger idea going on. So you don't have to get consumed with how ridiculous it is that a train could be zooming around the earth because there's other things happening.
Exactly.
That are, you know, keeping you on the edge of your seat. So.
And that's something that The Wandering Earth failed to do. The American movie it reminded me the most of, well, two movies actually, The Day After Tomorrow.
Yes.
And 2012.
Exactly.
Both Roland Emmerich movies. And so this is...
Sure he didn't ghost direct The Wandering Earth?
Well, it's like a Chinese Roland Emmerich movie.
Yep. And that's not a good compliment to you. But it's exactly, you've said it.
So I guess that's a little bit of a warning for this show, too. Really, like, The Wandering Earth is for rubberneckers. In defense of Roland Emmerich.
Really? You're going to defend that guy?
No, I guess I need to stop myself there.
Have you ever seen The Patriot?
Yes, that's his best movie.
It's the worst, one of the worst films I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's his best movie.
They turned how they effed up the Revolutionary War. God damn it, was that movie awful?
Yeah, it's Roland Emmerich's best movie. I'm serious. I'm challenging you to come up with one of his movies that's better than that.
I liked 2012 better than The Patriot.
Okay, well, 2012 is what I was going to say. Is it actually understands that it's a comedy?
Oh, it's hilarious.
It is hilarious, and it leans into the silliness and in a way that The Wandering Earth didn't.
I'm going to segue in because I don't want to spend a lot of time with it because it is also truly horrible, but it's in theaters now. Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
Oh.
Now, look, I will confess that the first Godzilla from a few years ago, which is not the first Godzilla, but the first of these new ones, I actually enjoyed. I thought it took a long time. It took a little bit too much, and I didn't like the monster character that it had to fight.
Right.
But I did enjoy it. I thought it had some filmmaking style, and there was a buildup and an excitement to the Godzilla that when he finally kind of does his thing, there was a payoff.
Right. So let me ask you a question about this newer this new Godzilla.
It's a direct sequel to that.
Oh, it is. Okay, so it's not in the Kong Skull Island world.
No. Because did you see Kong Skull Island? Okay, it is, because that was a universe based on that same Godzilla and the Monarch Project, which they mentioned at the end of, you know.
Okay, so this King is the Kong. Third film in this series.
It is, and they're setting up for a King Kong battle that may never come because this movie is not doing well. Here's the problem. Clearly, I'm sure they hired, like, this film director, Michael Dougherty. I was like, well, what did he direct? He directed Trick or Treat and Krampus, okay?
Okay.
I'm not sure why taps him on the shoulder for a big budget film like this, but he probably had a passion for Godzilla because, like, most kids, like, you know, we loved Godzilla from the Creature Features on Saturdays. And even though they were in suits and stuff, we still loved them. And they spoke a language to kids that we understood. And there was always an ecological component to these monster movies, that they were really products of man's misuse of nuclear testing.
Some of them are more pollution-based than nuclear.
Well, like the smog monster.
Yes.
So I know these movies, and the great thing is
I don't.
Oh, you don't? Oh, because you didn't have TV as a child.
Exactly. I did not grow up with the Godzilla movies. I have no real attachment to it.
Well, if you want to get attached, Criterion has these movies, and they're in the original language, not these terrible American dubs that I grew up watching. I'm watching them with my 7-year-old, and he loves them, and he doesn't mind that they're subtitles. He's reading along. They're great. But somewhere down the line, and I think it's a producer of these monster movies, they just look at them as a commodity that we have the CGI, people will just go to them.
Right.
And I don't think they really have any passion or caring about what makes these movies tick. And this Godzilla, King of the Monsters, is exactly the product of it. There's an ecological component, sort of, where there's ecological terrorists who they believe that, you know, hey, for the good of the world, we have to get rid of some people, and that these monsters are really there to clean up the waste of humanity. And I'm like, is this one of those Robert Langford movies? Because isn't that the plot of Angels and Demons?
Can you hear me groaning already?
Yeah. So this is that. That's the main story. It's a really weak story. And then there's this monsters. And it's directed horribly. Like, there's people in some kind of, like, super plane. But they look like they're on a studio set, like, of the Enterprise, kind of coordinating man movements throughout this thing.
Right.
The Millie Bobby Brown from The Stranger Things, she signed up. She made a mistake. She shouldn't have been in this movie. She does nothing in it, and they don't know what to do with her. And basically, here it is, kids. This is the formula, right? First of all, it should be set in Japan, right? You get a couple of school kids, right, wearing little beanies and having parents that are not around because they work.
Right.
That's your first setup. Then you got to get a couple of bank robbers that are holed up. There's like a side plot there, but then they somehow help the kids. And you got to get some intrepid news reporters. It's usually a male and a female, and that they have to go against their bosses and stuff. And then they team up and all in order to help the monsters. And of course, then you have to have some big bad meanie who either wants to use the power of the monsters. They want it for their money, monetary gain. So they're a big industrialist or something. But there was a great opportunity to tie this film in with climate change.
Right.
And you could have had some big baddie or big bad government people who have denied climate change. And there could be a great story there. And you could have taken a group of kids, right? These movies, they're for kids.
Yeah.
So kids identify. And that's why people like The Stranger Things, because it's got a bunch of teenagers. Right. They're trying to solve the day. And sure, they team up with the adults. But if you don't have the kids driving that along, it doesn't work.
Right. Even the Meg has kids.
Yes. And not enough, in my opinion.
Not enough. Right. True. But
this is so simple. I mean, look, I'm giving you the movie right here. How hard is it to make a good Godzilla movie?
Apparently, a lot harder than we thought.
And, you know, there's a lot of CGI and there's monsters. And they know there's a few, it's called Easter eggs, for those who watch the series, they had some Mothra throwbacks. They had Mothra sounds. There was Mothra music chants that clearly somebody, you know, watches the original movies. They mention Infant Island, which is where Mothra reigns supreme. And there's even a photograph of these two women who, if you've watched these monster movies, you know that they are the tiny princesses from Infant Island, who were always kind of the conduits between the adults and the monsters.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, my God. So you've got to watch Mothra and Mothra vs. Godzilla. And just they're so great. And you just got to watch these movies. You'll love them.
Okay.
And so instead, it's just a bunch of action scenes. And the CGI, I don't even think it's the greatest CGI, but there's no personality. You know, when you see the old movies, there are these people in rubber suits, and you know that these aren't real in the rubber suits, but it's actual physicality of two real people beating each other up. And when you see somebody swing like Godzilla around by the tail and throw him, it's just kind of cool. Whereas on the big screen with all the CGI and just big buildings crashing and stuff, all you start thinking about is, I wonder how many people have died.
Oh, well, you know, that's the same question I had going on throughout The Wandering Earth, right? Like they spend
they even tell you like billions, right?
Billions, right? But then they spend like 10 minutes of the movie crying because their grandfather died.
Oh, I know that. I always hate that. That was this whole thing, right, too. There's millions of people getting crushed by all of this activity in Godzilla.
Yeah.
And yet they're all focused on trying to save Millie Bobby Brown, who magically gets into Fenway Park and is like holed up in like a broadcasting booth or something. It's terrible.
This is just awful. Wow. Okay. Yeah. So I guess so far we've covered a bunch of movies that we didn't like.
And one of the things with Godzilla is like my youngest, and he liked it. He loves these monster movies.
Right. Yeah.
We decided with like a movie like Godzilla, we thought it would be fun to check out this thing called D-Box Cinema.
Oh, yes. I've heard about this.
Well, basically the thing about D-Box is it costs like $10 more per ticket.
Right.
That's the big thing about it. There's nothing.
But the concept is that it's kind of like Captain EO, right? It's not.
No.
Honey, I Shrunk the Audience. It's like.
It felt like a really cheap carnival ride.
Okay. That's what I'm getting. That's what I meant by Captain EO.
The seats are programmed. There's like a whole software package to the movie. So it's not like you just get random shakes of your chair. It actually is programmed for parts of the movie. It doesn't do anything the entire time. And you're sitting there. And these chairs do rock and shake and quake, which is kind of fun. And there are scenes, and there's a lot of scenes in Godzilla with helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
The seats actually feel like you're lifting up a little bit, like when the helicopter goes up. But you never feel – it feels like a stunt. It never feels like it's part of the movie.
Right.
And I much prefer some of the vibrations you get in an IMAX film.
Right. Okay.
And also this theater, it wasn't state of the art. It was like a 2K projector, so it was a little muddy. I was just like, I don't think I need to do the D-Box ever again.
Okay. Good to know. It's smell-o-vision.
It is. Now, okay, we've talked about the crap. Now we put the crap aside and let's get into some other things, if we can.
If we can pull ourselves away from, you know, Roland Emmerich.
It's hard. We don't want to give like 1 minute to something. So we talk about it. It's hard to, you know. But here's just something. I was very excited about this movie. And unfortunately, my local theater didn't play it. It didn't do well, which surprised me because I thought horror would do well. But there's this weird thing. Crappy, quick, scare you with like a jump scare type movies.
Yeah.
PG-13, what have you. Those do pretty well. For, you know, they're low budget.
Well, and it's like you were just saying about, I mean, it's not D-Box, but those are basically what I consider like carnival ride movies. You go there just to get a couple of jump scares and be creeped out a little bit. And other than that, the movie doesn't really matter.
Anytime a movie is in the horror genre and it tries to be anything more,
like
maybe a little bit art film, it doesn't get booked in theaters. People stay away from it. They critique it in ways they would never critique another horror film.
Yes.
They would say it's too long, it's this, it's that. And then it takes about 10, 15, 20 years before it becomes a classic and people think it's one of the greatest horror movies of all time. So Suspiria is the 2018 reimagining of the 1977 Dario Argento classic.
Yes.
And it was directed by Luca Guadagnino, who directed the Oscar-winning film Call Me By Your Name.
Yes.
And that seems like a very big departure to make a film about a male romance in like the early 80s and then go to Suspiria, which is, you know, kind of a horror film.
Which is, yeah, a horror film.
And now Amazon Studios released it, so I knew eventually it would come on Amazon Prime. And it did, and I got to see a 4K copy of the film.
Do you have any idea? Did it do much?
No,
it didn't.
It was a pretty much a bomb. I mean, I don't think Amazon is that vested in, you know, doing a big release strategy.
Right.
And if it does well for a few weeks, great. But it was 2.5 hours.
That really hurt it.
I saw the trailer for this thing, and I thought this thing looked like a horror masterpiece. It just boggles me. I guess I don't understand the horror genre and what drives people to the theaters. Because I like more of the highbrow
right.
horror movie, that I was going to probably like this film, but, you know.
The appeal of those other movies is cheap thrills, and this movie doesn't really have cheap thrills. It wants you to think a little bit more.
And yet, the funny thing is, it is based on the original 1977 yeah. film, which is like regarded as one of the great horror films.
Yeah.
So you would think there'd be a huge fan base that would want to check it out. But
well, no, because the original is so forgotten at this point.
You think so?
Nerds like it. You know, people like
okay,
people
yeah,
like
guess.
Us know about it. But I don't know. We should ask Millennial Will if he's seen it.
Well, okay, you make a good point, because, you know, my history with the original Suspiria, and I know we haven't even said whether we like the second one or not, but the original Suspiria, it's a film that I was too young to see when it first came out.
Right.
And, you know, it's not like that wasn't like a big box office hit either. It was just anything horror got released in second run theaters and the drive-ins.
Yeah.
But I think that it found its life on video. People loved horror on video and they checked it out. And by the time the mid-80s went around and I was really into horror in the early
yeah.
80s, it definitely, maybe through Fangoria magazine, it got a reputation.
Yeah.
So I had heard about the movie, but the thing that I heard about it, whether I knew anything about the story, was it is the scariest movie of all time.
Right.
The reason it got that reputation is because it came up with this great marketing ploy, and the ad said, the only thing scarier than the first 10 minutes of this movie are the last 20 or something.
Okay.
And that was just marketing.
Right.
But it stayed with it. And so I think it sort of almost did a hypnosis act on people where people had to believe it was this scary movie.
It's not that scary.
No. So 10 years after it was first released, 1987, fall of 87, the theater that I've mentioned many times, the Somerville Davis Square Theater.
Yeah.
They were just a single house revival theater at that point. A friend of mine, this guy Pete, found out that they were playing Suspiria on the big screen. So he wanted to go. So him and my friend Dave and I, we all went and saw Suspiria. And I admittedly at the time thought it was kind of boring. And I think that's only because my expectations were there was going to be
right.
some super scary movie. But the other thing that I noticed, and I think this is really part of what its appeal has been over the year, is there's this vibrancy to the colors that you do not see in any movie today.
Yes.
And that was because it was shot on film stock and processed with prints in Italy using a three-color dye transfer process that had already been discontinued in the United States, but there still was one processing plant left.
Oh, cool.
And it was the last movie that was printed that way. So what happened, especially only 10 years
right.
afterwards, it suffers very low fade.
Mm-hmm.
The colors are still vibrant, and they're always going to be more vibrant and almost painter-like and cartoony than a regular color film.
Right.
And also the use of the lighting and the sets, everything was to complement and highlight this very stylistic color choices.
Yeah.
And so that becomes the star of the show. It's very atmospheric, this weird music by Goblin. And so I appreciated it, but it was never one of my standard favorites. And I've seen it a second time. I saw an uncut version and enjoyed it. This film, while it follows the story, I think, pretty accurately, this new movie, it's way different. It's so far more in depth than the original.
Yeah, the original is like a very clean, straightforward, direct narrative line of this. And this movie digresses a little bit, maybe is a way to put it.
If we talk about the stylistic color choices and cinematography and the set design being super vibrant, the director of the new film, he goes a completely different route.
Yes, intentionally,
Yes, he still sets it in 77. He still sets it in Germany in a dance studio. He gives it more of a wintry look.
Mm-hmm.
And he tries to stay away from the color red as much as possible, except for when it needs to be used for, say, blood.
and one dance sequence that really uses red in an interesting way.
You know, he's got a toned down palette, but yet it's beautiful because, unlike most films shot today, this film is shot on actual film.
Yes, and what a difference it makes.
It makes a huge difference, and it's also one of Luca's traits is he likes to be a director of voyeur, and he employs a voyeuristic camera technique with a zoom lens.
Yes.
So he's capturing the action from afar, but he's zooming in, and he's moving the camera, and he's trying to give it a feel of movies that were shot a certain way 40 years ago
right.
but aren't today. I feel like that was very successful.
I would totally agree. The framing and the camera movement they put you on the edge of your seat.
And editing as well.
Yes, editing as well.
The screenplay, it fleshes out a lot of details that were never in the original film. And one of the knocks on the first film is it's a dance studio, but there's really no dancing in
right.
the movie. The second film is all about the dance.
They really put their work in on the dancing in this movie. The physicality of it, there's a lot of stuff about bodies in this movie.
Yes.
They're handled in the physicality of the movie and how these bodies interact with the physical space and with each other is really important to it. And the first sort of horror sequence in the movie is essentially a body horror sequence.
And that, from what I've heard, some people find that scene almost too gruesome to watch.
Yeah. So when that scene came on, I thought, wow. I am with this. That's the scene that sold me on the movie, actually, at the beginning. I was into it, but when that happened, I thought, oh, wow, this is actually kind of brilliant. It was disturbing to me.
For me, a good horror movie isn't like jump scares,
right.
etc. It's about things that are creepy and disturbing, and I feel like this movie accomplishes both of those.
I agree.
First of all, a little shout out to the performance of Dakota Johnson.
Yes.
After...
I have not seen any of those 50 Grey movies.
I saw the first one on TV. It was pretty bad, and I feel like that might have hurt her career by being part of those.
Yeah, I didn't. I don't think I'd ever seen her in anything before, but this is a really good performance. And
it's a very good physical performance.
Well, apparently,
she had to learn how to dance.
And apparently she spent like 2 years training to learn how to dance.
And it looks like it. I mean, there's probably some doubles and things, but I mean, some of the moves that are made, it could only be her.
Yes, quite a bit could only be her. Because, like should be done in movies where there's dance, there's long, full-frame shots.
I don't compare this movie to the original in that this is where they differ. There's sort of the overarching idea is the same, but in that film, short, Har and Jessica Harper, who I love and I thought was just excellent. She almost plays sort of the detective
right.
in that first movie. She's trying to figure out what's going on. And then, of course, there's a big reveal at the end. The mystery is solved.
Right.
And she kind of helps, you know, resolve that. But that's already been done. So what do we do here is instead of a big reveal that, the heads of the ballet are witches.
It's revealed in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's what. So what's fascinating is now instead of us focused on a mystery to be solved that we already know.
Yeah,
we're getting these behind the scenes discussions.
Yes,
with the witches,
and we don't know exactly the details of it. It more and more is
there's mystery.
Yeah,
there.
There's mystery there. So the detective role kind of falls to another character.
Yes.
And her friend. Another little shout out for performance for Mia Goth is the actress.
Yes.
And I've been following her for a few years now.
Mia Goth is great in this.
She is amazing in it. She has a really interesting face. Have you seen The Survivalist?
No, but I have seen, was she a Nymphomaniac, right?
You should see The Survivalist, by the way.
Okay.
But anyhow, shout out to her for a really cool performance.
Well, then there's the psychiatrist, right?
And then there's the psychiatrist.
You know, should we spoil that or should we not spoil that?
I think we should spoil that.
Because, I mean, I feel like if anybody reads up on it, one of the big things, and it was, I guess the decision was that since this whole story is kind of it's really about female empowerment.
Yeah.
There was the decision for this main psychiatrist character.
Who's this old man, a Holocaust survivor.
That he ended up being played by Tilda Swinton under amazing, amazing heavy makeup.
Yes. And we should point out she also plays one of the head witches.
At the end of the movie, yes.
Yes.
This one that gets talked about a lot.
Yeah.
And I kind of picked that
No. Well, she's that one and the other one. So she has three roles in this movie.
No, I'm not sure what I'm talking about.
Okay.
The one at the end.
Yeah.
She's that Mata.
Yeah, she's that Marco.
Marco, and she's got those glasses, and she's—I mean, that's like talk about that. The ending is super creepy.
Okay, I have an issue with the—I have an issue with the ending.
I have to take myself away from it. Is that the ending? It doesn't really—it doesn't seal the deal as the rest of the film leads up to. But I'm still okay with it.
Here's my issue with the ending: is I didn't like the way it was shot.
Interesting. I know what you're talking about.
You know, the final ceremony sequence, I'll call it. There is a moment in that with a lot of violence. And the camera, they did some post-processing on it or something, so it holds frames a little bit longer, and it's kind of like this jerky slow-mo thing.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a weird ending.
For
sure.
It's a really weird choice to shoot it this way, and it undermined the tension for me, and I wanted this last sequence to be shot, and I didn't like the way it was shot. It fell flat for me.
Because of that ending, which I still liked, but for me, the movie is a near masterpiece. That's just my bit, and I feel like over time, people are going to like start talking about this movie the way The Shining, which was not regarded well
right.
when it first came out.
In terms of the filmmaking, that's my only real issue is that last sequence, and it's just a filmmaking issue. And then, okay, so here's my other issues with the movie. I agree with you. I think it's a near masterpiece. I guess it's sort of the same issue is they're in this ballet school or this dance company, and they're pretty sealed in there, and they're in West Germany, and they're right next to the Berlin Wall, and the movie starts bringing in, not starts, right from the beginning and sort of throughout, there is a lot of politics going on in the background.
The Bader-Meinhof stuff?
Yeah, the Bader-Meinhof stuff. And
the movie is 2.5 hours,
yeah.
But doesn't it feel like they cut a half an hour out of it?
It does kind of, and it created context for sort of the time period, but it didn't really add to the meaning of the story for me.
I think they trimmed some stuff out because Chloe Grace Moritz...
Yes, is barely in it.
This feels like some of her role got cut out because there's a similar role in the first movie, and I feel like that was even more better explained than what happened here. So I do feel like the movie got trimmed a bit.
Okay, well, that would explain some of that.
But I don't know. I haven't done the research. Now, you did notice the cameo by Jessica Harper in it,
oh, of
right?
course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She plays the wife of the psychiatrist, which I thought was pretty cool that she actually had to learn German. She told the filmmaker she knew how to speak German because she didn't want to not get cast. So then she had to learn it.
That's awesome. Yeah. So that was actually my other issue is sort of the larger context to the movie, the Bader-Meinhof stuff and the Holocaust stuff. Both felt like sort of red herrings to me, and they make me critique the movie in a different way because it's not just a horror movie. It's trying to say something about politics and...
But you're wondering what it's trying to say.
And I can't quite figure out what it's trying to say.
And that might be why some critics have had a problem with it.
Yeah. Because it felt like it was trying to do more than just be a horror film, but it didn't quite succeed at being more. It succeeds at being a horror film.
So when you're critiquing horror and something that seems to kind of go a step above, it's obvious it's going a step above, but that's when it invites extra criticism because you're like, well, okay, what is it trying to say? And maybe it's a film that – and I'm not going to rewatch it right away, but I think it's something that I'm going to go back to.
I will definitely watch it again.
And but I think overall it sounds like you're pretty positive on
that. That was my one big thing was the Bader Meinhof and the Holocaust felt like red herrings. I couldn't quite add them up in terms of the meaning. They seemed a little tacked on and didn't add to the emotional response I was having to the film. What they did was it was like an attempt to add to my intellectual response.
And so, you know, you have a legitimate gripe. Now, I think when I get a movie that's giving me so much greatness, I am more willing to forgive those elements because it's trying to do way more than... I mean, I saw Godzilla, King of the Monsters, so bad.
Yeah, I mean, I saw Ant-Man, but, you know, those movies aren't even really worth digging into what works and doesn't work in a movie like Ant-Man.
Right, right.
Whereas this, because it's... elevated somehow, it invites more criticism.
But don't you think that a movie like this, when it finds its audience, people are going to be just for those that really find movies scary, aren't you think that there's going to be a group of people out there that are going to be finding this movie terrifying?
I think this movie is going to catch on. Okay, so I would like to compare this to another movie that I did not like and that I thought about while watching this, Hereditary.
Now, you know what? We're going to have to talk about Hereditary soon because I think it's going to have to be our duty to see Midsommar.
Yes.
Which I already have a lot of problems with, and I'll tell you why. Because there's going to be this whole crop of young people that are going to discover it and think it's the greatest horror movie, and they will have never seen The Wicker Man or any of the movies that are already riffing on. And so... the movie is already a negative in my book, but I've got to see it, and it's got to prove me wrong. And this time, unlike seeing Hereditary on the small screen, I will see Midsommar on the big screen.
Okay.
You're going to have to do the same.
I guess I'm going to have to do the same. But my point was basically just Suspiria worked on a lot of levels that Hereditary did not work for me.
We'll talk about widescreen use and how to use the frame, right? This is a movie that just he gets... how to shoot a frickin' movie.
Yes, exactly. And you know that right from the beginning and you feel like you're in good hands and you're willing to go with where he's going to take you for 2.5 hours.
Okay, so if we haven't intrigued you to check out Suspiria on Amazon Prime, then you're not going to check it out. But
but you really should. It's on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, we could talk about – we should really do an episode where we just take a movie and we just talk about the one movie the whole time. I don't know if people would like that or not. You can certainly send us a message.
Yeah, and if we do that, we're going to do Ant-Man.
Okay. No, we aren't going to do that. But there's a movie that I wanted to see a year ago in the theater, and I didn't get there, and – partly because it was like it's a long movie and, you know, it just looked like a B movie. Mm-hmm. But I think there's charms in B movies. And you saw it and I never got around to seeing it. And finally it came on HBO and HBO has really gotten with the times and they show things in the original aspect ratio. It's another film that it appealed to me for no other reason than it was actually shot on film.
Oh, that's why you wanted to see it. Okay.
I wanted to see it and... But it also just those kind of B-movie genre movies I like. It felt like a film that nobody makes anymore.
Right. It's sort of a twisty, turny crime.
Yeah. So I guess it's a sort of a new noir type of film.
Yeah, kind of is.
It's a movie called Bad Times at the El Royale. And you saw this.
Yes.
And started talking a little bit about it, but didn't want to go too in-depth.
I didn't want to give away too much for you. Yeah.
But I wanted to – the reason why I thought – besides the fact I finally saw this movie, is that I wanted to talk about it was because it also features Dakota Johnson.
Yes, it does.
Yes, so you have a double film.
That was the only other film I'd seen her in.
Her debut was in The Social Network.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I just didn't remember her from that. But
She hasn't been in a ton of movies. But anyways, but because she's in that, I thought, well, hey, it's a great, great time to talk about these two movies. And I will just start off saying that it's definitely a little mixed bag here or there, but overall, I really enjoyed this movie.
I enjoyed it. I think it was a little too long.
Well, you know, I watched it in parts.
Okay.
So it does make it feel a little bit less long. Okay. And based on the premise and what we're given, it should never have been this long.
Isn't it 2.5 hours?
It's close. It's like 2 hours and 20 minutes, okay. But it shouldn't have been 2 hours. It's directed by Drew Goddard, and he did Cabin in the Woods, yep. And he also directed a lot of the Lost episodes. And the star, to, for me, there's two stars of the show here. One is the cinematography by mm-hmm. Seamus McGarvey.
Yep.
And then the production design by Martin Wist.
Yeah, the third star I would throw in there is Jeff Bridges.
I would also say the actress and singer, Cynthia Erivo. She's a Broadway star, and she was the soul singer.
Oh, okay.
That's why you have never seen her. It was like her first right. film, but they needed somebody who could actually sing, and she won a Tony Award for The Color Purple on Broadway.
Yeah, because those two performances really...
They're the best part of the movie.
They're the best part. They really anchor the movie.
I also like this character actor who played the front desk guy, Lewis Pullman.
Oh, yeah.
I just recently saw him because I haven't talked about this because I'm only halfway through the series, but he plays Major in Catch-22.
Oh, okay.
And he's really good. So I kind of like that actor. So it's funny that you're watching one thing and an actor makes a standout and then you start seeing them pop up in other things.
You mean like Chris Hemsworth?
Okay, so now you're bringing up. So you're cutting to the chase here because that's the biggest problem with the movie. That performance, that character needs – he is miscast. He's not yes. that great an actor. He doesn't have the range, and he plays it completely wrong.
Yes, and it's like he's in a different movie.
Yeah, so unfortunately – when that big sort of Tarantino intensity scene comes in,
yeah.
it just shows you the skills of a director of Tarantino because he could pull off a scene like that. And that's where the film is tense, but it's just the climax of the movie. It just doesn't work as well as it could have under better direction.
Exactly. And it's dragged out. Again, I yep. feel like a lot of the cutting could have been done within scenes almost.
Yeah. So I think that Drew Goddard, he shot for a grand slam. He may have hit a double. But that's kind of the classic part of what a B movie.
Well, I guess that's and when we're talking about sort of evaluating movies differently, there was nothing in this movie that made me think it was going for anything much deeper than just a twisty character story, you know, or
I can see why actors signed on for it. It's really fun.
Oh, it's totally fun, but it's a pulpy B movie with some good twist and some decent performance. It's a good pulpy B movie is what it is. It just should have been shorter.
Where it worked for me is that, again, when you're shooting the movie on film, it has a look
yes.
that is really delicious. The place itself, the El Royale, is a character.
Yes.
And yeah. And in order for it to be a character, every little detail has to be really, really awesome. And
the production design is awesome.
Also great.
Yeah.
And I also like here's another widescreen movie where I will say that what's in the frame, it feels like the right kind of widescreen movie. It feels like that's the way it should have been.
Yeah.
And as opposed to so many that just like, why did they shoot it widescreen?
And it's interesting to have a movie where the widescreen works really well. That's also an enclosed space movie. Like the whole thing takes place in one location.
Yeah. I mean, it's like all a set, but like, okay, when you're doing a film like that and it's a set, what do you do to stylize it, to bring yeah. it up to a notch, to a filmic level? And this film says, yeah, we know you're watching a movie and we're going to have a lot of fun with that notion.
Exactly.
Because it's also about voyeurism, right? There's that whole other aspect.
It's absolutely about voyeurism. And but it's I got to say, this movie to me was fun. I enjoyed it. I don't know if I would highly recommend it to people unless that's just kind of the thing you're into.
Well, I think that's why it didn't do well. Like, it's not the kind of movie you say, oh, run out to the theater and see. But man, I will tell you, if you got HBO, you should watch this thing.
Okay. So you're I think, a slightly bigger fan of the movie than I am. Oh, but
yeah, I was a really big fan. Again, I didn't like necessarily how it resolved. I didn't, and it was not because of the way it was just, I just don't think the direction was up to the task.
Yeah.
And again, it was a bit long here and there. Again, if you watch it in parts, it won't feel that long.
Right. I mean, it doesn't feel overly long. It's just, had it been tighter, it could have been, it would have made it just a better movie if it had more intensity. As it is, it feels a little bit loose at times.
Yeah. And then again, you know, if you're not as sophisticated a film watcher as we are, I think you're going to be in for like a wild ride. There's lots of surprises.
There are lots of surprises. Yeah.
And so it's just a fun ride. And I think they were making a lot of these types of movies, thanks to Tarantino, in the 90s.
Yes.
But they're not making a lot of those types of movies anymore.
Yeah. It is kind of almost a 90s throwback in a way.
Yeah, it feels like 90s.
Yeah.
You know, I know it's set in 1969, but it feels like the 90s.
Yes,
it does. That it was made. yeah, and you know, Jeff Bridges, you know, now he's older, he's kind of developed a character.
Yeah.
This grizzled guy who's sort of a version of Jeff Lebowski. Here's the first time in a while he's Jeff Bridges all the way, but he's a different character.
He's a different character. And really, I think without that performance, there's no movie. To me, he put the whole thing together.
Yeah, I liked John Hamm's character. I enjoyed him.
No, some of the other characters are fun, but like Jeff Bridges, to me, is the emotional core of the movie.
Ultimately, I think it works is because you do care
about
his character, and you do care about Cynthia Erivo's character.
Yes.
And, you know, so...
Exactly, yeah. Both of them... they create some sort of emotional center for the movie, which makes it work better than it might otherwise.
So, you know, sort of a mix, but a thumbs up on Bad Times at the El Royale for you.
Yep, I'll give it it's a mixed bag, but ultimately a thumbs up.
I give it a thumbs up. And Suspiria, the new version, I give a high thumbs up to. you give it a thumbs up. You're not going to give it a high thumbs up.
Yes, I'm definitely giving it a thumbs up with a few reservations. But they're fairly minor. I mean, I think if you're into horror movies, you have to watch this movie. It's great.
That's what I'm thinking. Is that especially if you like, you know, would like to have something a little different than you're normally given.
Yeah.
This movie, you know, definitely elevates. And if you're a fan of Hereditary, right? Then you got to give this one a shot because this is horror done right.
Exactly. And throughout this was another thing I was thinking during the movie was the sound design is great.
Yes.
And that was something that bothered me in Hereditary.
There's a lot of things that bothered me in Hereditary. No, I liked it more than you.
Than I did, but.
My thumb was halfway on that, but halfway with a little bit of pointing down. and then, of course, way down for Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
Yes, just avoid
very
that.
Very disappointed.
The whole first half of this program is actually things that are pretty much way down.
Yeah, and you know, we still haven't gotten to a major disagreement yet. I know eventually it'll happen. As a matter of fact, Suspiria might be as close as we've gotten. but I think it's because we appreciate quality and we don't appreciate crap. So that's why it makes it pretty easy.
Well, unless it's really fun crap.
Yeah.
Like The Meg.
True. Yes, and Hobbs and Shaw coming out on August 2nd.
Can't wait.
My wife says that she feels like that movie's supposed to have come out months ago, and that what happens is they keep deciding to add more to it, because every time she watches a trailer, it seems like new things happen. So she feels like they just keep going, wait a minute, let's go back and film something else so we can put in this movie. But she's on board now.
They've already shot 5 sequels.
I think that's probably what's taking so long. But I mean, it's Hobbs and Shaw.
Oh, I know.
And it's got Vanessa Shaw in it. That's like a super plus in my book. Yeah, she was awesome in The Crown. She's awesome in the Mission Impossible, the last one, and she's now either Hobbs or Shaw's sister, whichever one is the British guy.
Yeah, I don't know which one is which, and I'm not sure it matters.
Oh. Hey, you know what? This has been like super fun, and as always, it says like I don't feel like I want to wrap up, but we have to.
We got
to
wrap up.
We have to wrap up. So, anyways, thanks everybody. Hope you've been enjoying the program as always. We're getting into the summer, right? Summer's coming, and that means we may not have as frequent a supply of episodes, but I think we're committed to getting out as many as we can.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, so just keep on checking. We now have, you know, we have a Facebook page, and I've invited people to just join that if you want to keep up to date on Facebook with what we're doing. Then there's the Stuff We've Seen website. There's the Instagram. There's the Twitter. And then, of course, there's the show, which you can get in, on our website or on iTunes or any of those other places where you get your podcast fix.
Thanks.
All right.
Thanks
all
for
right,
listening.
Anything else there?
No, I mean, I could just keep going, but I'm going to stop now. I think we should stop now.
Yeah, I'm tired now. All that crap wore me down. Okay, so stay safe, everyone, and go see some stuff.
Yeah, see some summer movies.
Bye.
Bye.